Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 179 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. And now, on to our read-along! Discussing the beginning of part six, which the part is entitled Edinburgh, and we begin with chapter 24, entitled A. Malcolm, comma Printer.
Anne S. writes, A. Malcolm Printer, a.k.a. what we have waited the last 300-odd pages for. Martina P. writes, here we are. Finally, the climax of this entire book, in my opinion. It is the heart of the story and my favorite, the print shop. Lisa T. writes, this chapter is one of the most pivotal chapters in the entire series. I'd compare its significance to the wedding sequence in Outlander. Claire has arrived. Quote, my first coherent thought was, it's raining. This must be Scotland. Unquote. Thoughts of Bree and what she'd left behind surface, and she feels as if she's been punched in the stomach. Then she feels the point to which she'd clung. Her lifeline. Jamie. She has no idea how long it had been since she'd gone through the stones, perhaps a day or two, and she'd fallen under a rowan tree. The Highland protection against witchcraft and enchantment is what the tree stands for. That's funny. Lisa T. writes, just as Jamie regained consciousness and awareness of himself and his loss of Claire on Culloden Moor, Claire awakens, quote, some small sense of who I was and where I was beginning to come back to me. Bree, her face emerged suddenly into memory with a jolt that made me gasp as though I'd been punched in the stomach. Jagged images of loss and the rip of separation pulled at me a faint echo of the chaos in the stone passage, unquote. But then Claire, unlike Jamie, Lisa continues, finds her anchor point, a perfect nod to the title, Voyager. Jamie is that anchor point. And there it was, the anchor point to which I had clung, my single hold on sanity. I breathed slow and deep, hands folded over my pounding heart, summoning Jamie's face. For a moment, I thought I had lost him, and then it came, clear and bold, in my mind's eye. Further, I was alive, though. Alive, and with a small feeling of certainty, like a tiny glowing sun beneath my ribs, he was here. I knew it now, though I hadn't known it when I threw myself between the stones. That had been a leap of faith. But I had cast out my thought of Jamie like a lifeline, tossed into a raging torrent, and the line had tightened in my grasp and pulled me free. I was wet, cold, and felt battered, as though I had been washing about in the surf against a rocky shore. But I was here, and somewhere in this strange country of the past was the man I had come to find. The memories of grief and terror were receding as I realized that my die was cast. Unquote. So Lisa writes, the tiny glowing sun is a reference to her feelings for Jamie. Somehow he is part of her and alive. I also love the references to the sea and surf. Claire is definitely a voyager. Martina P. writes, I greatly enjoy reading about Claire's journey once she wakes up at Crena Dun. Her arrival in Edinburgh really feels like a homecoming. She clearly feels more at home in the 18th century than in her own time. Eileen P. writes, I always find it interesting that even though Claire has the ability to pass through the stones and travel through time, it is an arduous journey. It is physically painful and mentally challenging. It speaks to the need to take risks and even make sacrifices to not just achieve goals, but to grow as a person and self-actualize. It's as if time traveling compresses a lifetime of challenges into an instant.
Now, when we talk about time travel, how awful it is, isn't it more awful? Doesn't that been discussed that it's more awful because she doesn't do any of the things you're supposed to do? She literally just falls through time,
Whereas, you know, they have Galus was looking, you know, had the blood sacrifice and having the stones and the jewelry and things. That all of those things were to help you steer and to maybe make the passage a little less awful. You don't really hear, you only hear about her family who literally just falls through time without any notion of how it happens, at least at this point in the series. But none of the other people who travel talk about how awful it is.
That's true. We don't hear, well, we can't say much more.
That's it.
Because the only person we know by now who travels are those two. Yeah. Joe B. writes, Claire comes to the surface, experiencing the physical remnants of the passage mixed with high emotion. The grief of missing Bree juxtaposed with the hope and anticipation of Jamie. It is the image of Jamie that she clings to under the rowan tree. There are images of sailing features here, submerged, lifeline, anchor point, and perhaps a foretaste of what's to come. But the lifeline she casts out is caught in her certainty of Jamie, that here is the right time and that he is here. It reminds me of the chain that links Diana and Matthew in the All Souls trilogy. Oh my gosh, that is exactly what she, oh my gosh. Joe, I thought about that, but I thought maybe we shouldn't mention the other, you know, trilogy in case people hadn't read about it. But yeah, when I was reading this to prep for tonight, prep my notes, I thought when she like puts out her anchor point or whatever she does, she like throws something out and she can feel him. I thought immediately of that chain that Diana and Matthew have. Of course, Voyager, Joby writes, was written well before. She has crossed her Rubicon and can't or won't return to the stones. So she goes to meet again an old yet brave new world. She's working on a combination of hope, historical interpretation, and faith. In fate and in Jamie, but she has a plan, as we expect her to. In Edinburgh, where Roger found him, if not there, then to Lallybroch. This passage had been bad, her worst. She felt Jamie, he was here. As she couldn't go back, she set herself resolutely to go forward. She was going to walk 40 miles to Inverness, if need be. Good golly, we don't know how long that took her. Her plan was to get to Inverness, however she could, and then use public coach to get to Edinburgh. She would first search there and then go to Lallybroch if need be. On the coach to Edinburgh, there's a man wearing a bag of camphor and asafoetida around his neck. And obviously this is, with all the description that Diana gave us, it's obviously a horrible smell, but I, of course, had to look it up. Asafoetida is the dried latex or gum resin exuded from several species of ferula, a perennial herb. As its name suggests, asafoetida has a fetid smell, but in cooked dishes delivers a smooth flavor reminiscent of leeks. So basically it smells like camphor and death. In close quarters.
I would just like to take a moment and go back and say something that you did not touch on.
Okay.
And that was the fact that Diana did your homework for you. And
about asafoetida?
No, about the rowan tree.
Well, that was nice of her, Diana. Thank you. Claire is reassured to find that men are still attracted to her. And in my notes, well, not so much in my notes. I just relayed what happened, mostly what happened in the chapter with a little, you know, some connections as I could. But man, the comments we got, quite a few noticed or pointed out that Claire is, I mean, I think we can give her a little bit of, you know, the benefit of the doubt, obviously, because she's not very insecure. She's just trying to allay her fears because she hasn't seen love of her life in 20 years. And yes, she keeps it tight, but you never know, you know, that person, she's not the 28-year-old or whatever she was when she left.
It's more than that though. And it's, I think that it's a combination of
aging.
Well, it's aging, but also for probably the last, 15, 17, 18, close to 20 years, she has had she's become a non-sexual being.
Oh, well, that's
so, and that a lot of new moms have this, where they go through a period where they're just like, I don't feel like a sexual being anymore. I'm a mother. And I think that because the nature of her relationship with Frank, and cheating on him with anybody else. She reverted to a non-sexual state where she was Bree's mom and she was a doctor. And those are the only things she did. So now with the reintroduction of Jamie and the possibility of Jamie coming back into her life, she's seeing that this side of her that she's been neglecting for the last 2 decades is now starting to kind of come to life again. And she's worried that she, you know, it's been so long, maybe she doesn't remember how to do it.
Or how to be that person. She's worried that she doesn't have to, maybe how to be that person or how to respond correctly or something. I think, like she says later, it's like falling off a bicycle. The actual mechanics are, she's not worried about the mechanics, but it's the emotion and the getting to that part. Once you get to it, it's like the bike. But getting to the bike, I think, is what, you know, will he like the bike, you know, or whatever. So, yeah. So Claire is reassured to find that men are still attracted to her. As she thinks of Jamie, she touches a small, hard rectangle in her skirt pocket. And we know what that is. She makes a narrow escape from Mr. Wallace, who was on the coach next to her, and he wants to accompany her, basically anywhere. She sits for a rest on a public fountain and recalls the last time she'd been there, when Bonnie Prince Charlie had been addressing his crowd. She thinks briefly on Charlie, but that is all. She kind of says, basically, I wouldn't say she wasn't as kind as, say, go with God, but she's like, dude, he's out of my life. He's going to be doing on what he's doing on. Joby writes, in Edinburgh, Claire is resting after her quick exit from her carriage companion and remembering her previous life in the city. The euphoria after winning at Prestonpans combines with her remembrance of Charles Stewart. His stunt on this fountain, symbolic of the man himself, he looked good, sounded good, and made enthusiastic, passionate gestures to play a king. But in the end, that's what Claire and many historians see him as, a young man of gestures and actions without substance. Like Claire, Charlie also left for exile, but now she is back, ready to salvage a new life in the wreckage he left. Edinburgh is also the place where she was at her most powerful, as the wife of a close confidant of the prince, as a notable healer, where she was able to influence and at least try to alter history in her secret dealings with Jack Randall. So she is eating her last peanut butter and jelly sandwich, thinking of making that very sandwich for Brianna when she was in school. And I love this line, quote, I swallowed the last rich, sweet bite of my old life and crumbled the wrapper in my hand, unquote. And then one of the mysteries of the series, the plastic baggie, quote, I glanced around, but no one was looking in my direction. I opened my hand and let the bit of plastic film fall surreptitiously to the ground. Wadded up, it rolled a few inches on the cobbles, crinkling and unfolding.
Now, I read that as like, just saran wrap, not even a bag, because she was just like the film.
You're right. The plastic film is what, like, probably like the kind that sticks to itself.
Yeah, like cling wrap.
Yeah. Yeah. Wadded up, it rolled a few inches on the cobbles, crinkling and unfolding itself as though alive. The light wind caught it, and the small transparent sheet took sudden wing, scuttling over the gray stones like a leaf, unquote. It disappeared under a cart and was gone. Joe B. writes, her last link with her 1960s is PB&J, a remembrance of Bree, but not of home. Home is here. Despite the public littering, I really like the image of the plastic wrap floating like a feather at the end of Forrest Gump over the city as Claire makes her move toward Carfax Close.
Or is it more like the plastic bag in American Beauty?
Oh, or that. Martina P. writes, this might be a very odd observation, but the peanut butter and jelly sandwich wrapped in plastic foil always stands out to me and weirdly takes me out of the story. It made me wonder where she made the sandwich. She could not have possibly brought it from Boston. Born and raised in Europe, peanut butter was simply not available to us until, I don't know, maybe the 80s. Sorry for nitpicking, but it does distract me each time. Maybe peanut butter and jelly sandwiches were commonly consumed in Scotland in the 60s. So that's a good point. Eileen P. writes, nice to know peanut butter and jelly sandwiches can pass with you through the stones. They truly are non-perishable. Claire is so thoughtful. So, having gotten rid of her last, well, not the last, but the last link to her old life, mostly, she asks a young boy where Alexander Malcolm, the printer, is. The boy points in one direction and says, Carfax Close. She's on her way. She looks at herself in a plate glass window and compares her wayward curls to Medusa. They're all over the place, so she takes it down and redoes her hair. She recognizes the apothecary shop that she'd been to during the time before Culloden. And she notices a woman finishing up her business inside, and as she comes out, she notices that she's in better shape than she is, but she wants to confirm her age just to make sure. She finds out the woman was at least 29, and Claire looked younger than her, even at almost 50. Deborah C. writes, I was a bit surprised Claire felt insecure about her looks. She had studied herself in her bathroom mirror in Boston, asked Joe A. to confirm that her figure was still fine, and now in Edinburgh, favorably compares herself to a 29-year-old mother of three.
Dude, let's be honest with this. Getting a verbal okay from a bunch of people and seeing, you know, I look all right. None of those things will ever take the place of seeing Jamie and him going, hey, you look good. It's because that's Joe's opinion. That's Hermia's opinion. That's, you know, other people's opinion. The only opinion that's going to matter ultimately, the one that she cares about, is Jamie.
So, and I think that's their point, is that she keeps asking all these people when in the end, it doesn't matter what they say. But it's in an attempt to reassure herself. Anne S. writes, first of all, I understand why Claire is insecure about Jamie still being attracted to her, but really, does she have to be so awful about it? She finds some 18th century woman with bad teeth to make her feel better about herself. Her vanity is particularly cruel and a bit shallow. All of her worrying about Jamie still finding her attractive after 20 years, and she never once worries about if he will still care for her. And if she had gotten heavier or grayer or wrinkly, does that not make her worthy of love? Does Claire even like women very much? The lack of any significant female characters in these books makes it hard for her to have friends, but even with the few available, she either competes with them, Jenny, or just feels superior to them. Her only friend in Boston is a male coworker, and she is distant in her relationship with Bree. Claire, relax a bit and join a book club. She doesn't seem to care for her children. Excuse me. She doesn't seem to care for children much either. They seem to be annoying, snot-nosed, or whiny. And then she litters. Back to the plastic film. So who knew that the giant swirling continent of plastic in the Pacific Ocean began in 1765? And what, of course, she's referring to is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. According to Wikipedia, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, also described as the Pacific Trash Vortex, is a gyre of marine debris particles in the central North Pacific Ocean discovered between 1985 and 88. The patch extends over an indeterminate area with estimates ranging very widely depending on the degree of plastic concentration used to define the affected area. So basically, it's plastic, chemical sludge, and other debris that all from currents end up in this area. And she's referring to this. And I'll link that. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Anne continues, Claire keeps making references to new beginnings, especially caterpillars and chrysalis, the poster, the passengers from the coach, etc. And of course, Claire in her dress, or from her dress. Martina P. writes, Diana describes very well how stressed Claire is about her imminent reunion with Jamie. We also see another demonstration of Claire's insecurity about her physical appearance and vanity on the expense of a poor tooth missing, malnourished, slightly wrinkled face 29-year-old 18th century woman. This leaves no more doubt for us to believe that Claire's hotness could have suffered in 20 years. Nevertheless, a beautiful description which takes us to the big moment. She winds down Carfax Close and finds the sign. A. Malcolm, printer and bookseller. She goes straight in. She sees him. His back is to her, bent over the printing press. He asks, facing the opposite direction, if it were Geordi. She says, it isn't Geordi. It's me, Claire. Joe B. writes, her first view of Jamie is less than dignified. She is made to wait to see his face, although the back view is good too. After much focus on Claire's physical appearance, the tension is increased as we are made to wait to see Jamie. It is in her response to Jamie that her emotions get expression. Since the chaos of the stones and its immediate aftermath, Claire has held herself in check as a way of self-preservation, I think. her emotional release of joy, relief, come out of her as her voice betrays her. It's me, it's Claire, has a depth that is more than a reintroduction. It's a first statement of her reclaiming the true version of herself. Before she came through the stones, this time, she most often referred to herself in relationship to another, to Frank, Bree, Joe, recalling her story in response to the interventions of others. Frank starts the fight that kills him, Joe Abernathy introduced himself, and Bree needed her mother. But what she shares of her remembrances of Jamie, other than in Bree, are of times of sleep and rest, in the plane going back to Boston, and in her dreams, when she is vulnerable, where she dreams of making love with Jamie, the other times she is vulnerable, where she never held herself back and was met with the same honesty, a space where they are equally demanding of each other. Back in the print shop, Jamie is shocked. She launches in with, "When did you break your nose?" She sees him. She gets closer, obviously, and she's looking at his face and the slight differences. And she just starts off with, "When did you break your nose?" When she touches him on the nose, he flinches and says, "You're real," and promptly faints. She sits on the floor with him holding his head in her lap, and she notes the scar at his throat. So she's just like recounting or re-remembering all the bits and pieces of him that she remembered.
Reacquainting herself.
Yep.
I also think that there was no greater icebreaker than him fainting.
Nope. That's it. Everything. I mean, they still have to get through stuff, but yeah, that clears the board right there.
But I mean, think about how much time she's had to think.
Oh yeah. She mentioned that too. It's not fair
to him. And then literally the best she's got is, "It's me, Claire. I'm back. Honey, I'm home."
And after he comes to, she asks, "That bad, is it?" He replies, "That bad and worse." Now, there's a lot of truth behind that reply, and it will take a few chapters to get to it all.
Dude,
but
there are so many moments, like in these chapters, where I'm like, ooh.
They both cry, holding each other, immediately revisiting their hasty goodbye at the Stones the last time they saw each other. Quote, "Suddenly, I couldn't bear not to be touching him. I lunged at him, and he got his arms up just in time to catch me. I squeezed until I heard his ribs crack and felt his hands roughly caressing my back as he said my name over and over." Unquote. Now, he'd sat on the ink.
Can
when
we talk
he fell.
About that for a second? How weird, how I would find that a little creepy. For instance, and maybe it's just because I have a weird name, but whenever they have, like, I read a book where the dude is like saying the woman's name like over and over again, or like saying the woman's name during crucial moments, I always think it's a little creepy. Like, I think it would be weird if somebody randomly was just saying my name.
I don't know.
I don't think it's sexy. Maybe it's not. Again, it could just be the nature of my name, but yeah. I wouldn't. Just like I have never, and granted, I know that they're not consummating anything at this moment, but like I have nothing else to say, so I'm just going to say your name over and over again. I just think it would be weird and awkward to be like hugging somebody and have them just keep saying your name over and over again. Ginger, Ginger, Ginger.
Well, I don't plan on starting that. So. He looks down and he sees that there's like some wetness on his breeches, and he had actually not soiled himself. He had sat when he fell. He broke a bottle of ink that was in his breeches.
An ale pot. Yeah, it was beer.
Oh my gosh. It was a small one.
It was an ale. I've just sat on the ale pot.
Oh, okay. I don't
know
where I got ink from.
A pool of aromatic brown liquid was spreading slowly beneath him.
Ah, okay. So not ink.
Ink would have made sense because it was a print shop, but you know,
that's what I mean. And also would have been dark though, so it would have stained. So he takes his pants off. He takes his breeches off. Lisa T writes, "As humorous as this passage is, it also reestablishes their relationship as husband and wife. So basically, if the faint had not been enough of an icebreaker, him pantsing himself when it looked like he peed himself, but he actually didn't, that's an icebreaker too. They're a little shy around each other. She tells him she never took his ring off, and he kisses her. They kiss, stroke each other, refamiliarizing themselves with one another. Jamie says, quote, "I've seen you so many times. You've come to me so often. When I was afraid and so lonely, I knew I must die. When I needed you, I would always see you, smiling with your hair curling up about your face. But you never spoke, and you never touched me," unquote. She replies, "I can touch you now." He cups her face between his hands and says, "Dinna be afraid. There's the two of us now." Lisa T. writes, "This scene is about them reclaiming each other, as they have done many times. The scene ends with Jamie telling Claire that there's the two of us now, as he did on their wedding night. It is also reminiscent of the scene in Outlander, when he gives Claire her ring and they reclaim each other after he tossed her." What is tossed?
Tossed?
T-A-W-S-E-D.
It sounds like a typo to me.
Cain and tossed in Scottish law. It's corporal punishment. So let me see.
A tawse is a thong with a slit end, formerly used in schools for punishing children.
I know. I just Googled that too. But later on, the third hit down, it says corporal punishment, cane and tawse in Scottish, whatever, Scottish schools. So it is also reminiscent of the scene in Outlander when he gives Claire her ring and they reclaim each other after he tawsed her. And of course, I had to look that up. That basically, it's when he basically spanked her, beat her. Also of Jamie reclaiming Claire in Dragonfly and Amber after she lost faith and slept with the king. The juxtaposition of these earlier scenes with Claire and Jamie finally finding and discovering each other again makes their reunion so heartbreaking, powerful, and beautiful. They have chosen each other yet again. So they are interrupted when the shop bell rings. It's Stewardy, who sees Jamie with his breeches gone, holding a woman. And he basically says, "Here's your packages. I quit." It's too much for him.
He does way more than that. Like, he had a little
meltdown.
No, like a
tantrum.
No, it was monologue, but there was a descriptive word I wanted to use. A self-righteous monologue.
I worked for you, even everyone else said this, and you're a papist, and I still worked for you, and all this, and but I will not have you doing this with your. I
remember it.
He may not have said papist, but I'm sure he put the Catholic thing out there. So after Geordie takes his leave, very dramatically, they go upstairs together, and she sees the place where he sleeps is balm for her soul. He puts on another pair of breeches. And he says simply, "The child." She gets him to sit next to her, and she pulls out her small rectangular bundle, undoing its waterproof wrapping. Of course, these are the pictures of Bree, a timeline of her life made up of snapshots. And then she says, "Your daughter sent this to you," and gives him her kiss. As she shows him the pictures one by one, and describes the scene, she also gets choked up that she'll never see their daughter again. His hands were shaking so badly he couldn't hold them. So she takes them and starts to hand them to him one by one. After the last of the pictures, quote, "He splayed a hand out over the photographs, trembling fingers not quite touching the shiny surfaces, and then he turned and leaned toward me, slowly, with the improbable grace of a tall tree falling. He buried his face in my shoulder and went very quietly and thoroughly to pieces."
It's my favorite line in this book, by the way.
Oh, it's a gorgeous line. He asks her name, and when she says Brianna, let's just say he's a little less than happy. He says, quote, "What an awful name for a wee lassie." She gets indignant. She's like, "You asked me to name our child after your father." And he's like, "Oh, I did, didn't I?" And then he kind of comes around and he's like, "Okay, it's actually Brianna."
No, she gets indignant twice. First it was, "That's a horrible name for a girl." And then she's like, "Yeah, well, I told you that. I told you I told you to name the baby Brian because I thought it was a boy." And she's like, "Wait, now you don't want it to be a boy? You got something against having a daughter?" Yeah, it was It was an open mouth, insert foot moment for sure.
And then he comes around and says, no, 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 of course, you know, a daughter's fine. I just thought it would be a boy, but it's not the way you pronounce it. It's Brianna, which is interesting because with the emphasis on the first syllable, it's close to the Scottish Gaelic word for pretty or beautiful, or one of them. There are a few, and that I named my cat after, and that is Bria. The hours go by as they continue to reconnect. Her gurgling stomach brings him to the thought of food. And then at this point, he realizes that it's late and he's forgotten Mr. Willoughby. We don't know who that is yet, but he's forgotten him. He was meant to go for him at noon. It's now 4. He hurriedly puts on his shoes, gives Claire a snack, and pausing at the door, asks, "You'll come with me?" And she replies, "Wild horses couldn't stop me."
Now, the first time I read this book, and they mentioned
Wild horses.
No. The first time I read this book.
Couldn't kick me away. Sorry, I had to finish the phrase. Lisa T. writes, "This scene is the ultimate validation for Jamie. He realizes that he did save his wife and child when he sent them through the stones. I think for Claire, it is about finding Jamie. But for Jamie, it's knowing that the sacrifice he made by sending Claire back was truly worth it. He has prayed for her and the child for 20 years. He never thought that he'd know that his prayer was answered. The fact that his prayer is answered is momentarily overwhelming for Jamie." Eileen P. writes, "We're finally here. We've been waiting for the Jamie Claire reunion for ages. Here they are together in the same room. Didn't you think they were going to have a fraction of a second of speechlessness and then just run into each other's arms? Instead, who faints? Jamie." Well, that was unexpected. I didn't see that coming, and it's so sweet. He'd been dreaming about Claire throughout the 20 years apart. He was shocked to discover she was actually real and not a vision. And down he goes. That bad, is it? It is so wonderful to have Jamie and Claire reunited, to have them both shaking and crying in each other's arms, knowing that they both longed for each other. A tentative kiss, becoming reacquainted. The 20 years of separation, of living a fragmented life apart, has been shattered. And in turn, Jamie and Claire have embraced joyously in the return of wholeness. Totally relieved to know Jamie's room is as spare as a monk's cell, and that he sleeps alone. No signs of feminine presence. Yes! It would be awful for Claire to go back and be reunited with Jamie, only to have him say, "Nice to have you back, Claire. Let me introduce you to my girlfriend."
Or his wife.
or a wife. For 20 years, Jamie had to live not knowing if Claire and his child had survived passing through the stones. As he looks through the photographs of his daughter, Brianna, he is a jumble of emotions. Relief, joy, love. But there is also the pain of having been separated from his child for the past 20 years. I think seeing her pictorially growing up before his eyes is overwhelming. It is more than he could ever imagine.
I mean, just imagine, I mean, as a parent, just when I go back and look at pictures of my daughter when she was tiny and when she was a baby, I can't imagine having never known any of those things. And that's the only way to experience it. You know, where I get the nostalgia of looking back and going, oh, she was so tiny, or she was so cute, or she was so quiet. Now she's not. But to have that be the only experience, and not only gain the knowledge of those moments, but to also have it fully come home, how much you missed and how much you didn't get to experience.
Joe B. writes, "There is now opportunity to have the acceptance, understanding, and championing that she had with him before again. It gives Claire a chance to be her true self again. Claire has brought photos of Bree, and as much as Jamie is overwhelmed by his daughter, it is a time where Jamie's being a man of his 1760s time comes out. Somewhat like Frank having issues with the Abernathys, Jamie, for all he is different from other men, still has the prejudice that he will, of course, have a son." Claire's reaction is both, because she comes from her own time, and because she loves her daughter and has taken a massive step to leave her. Jamie's inadvertent and instinctive reaction to his surprising daughter brings up fear in Claire that she isn't welcome either. Quick reassurance from Jamie has its effect, and he sensibly asks for more about her. Anne S. writes, "The reunion is so beautifully written. I have reread it many times. My only question was, why did she look for the BJR scar to confirm that it was Jamie? Wasn't his face enough? She even knew it was Jamie before he turned around." I noticed that too. I don't think that she needed to find it to make sure it was Jamie. I think that she was sure it was Jamie when she saw his backside. I mean, she knew his height, his build, his hair, everything. I think, like Summer and I were kind of saying, it was just like, oh, your nose, your eyes, you're this, you know, you're like, she already said your nose is broken, you're different. And she was looking for things that were different and searching his face and looking for everything that she remembered, because she didn't have pictures, right? She was looking for everything that she remembered. And because his neck was exposed enough to see it, she was grasping for anything. And that was like another thing, like, oh, there's that spot. Like, oh, there's the, if you saw pictures, oh, that's the place we had that romantic picnic. Oh, that's the place we went for our vacation. You know, if you're looking through pictures, she doesn't have those. And she has his face, all his contours, his body, that map, that is her picture. So she's, him looking at pictures of his daughter, even though he missed her life growing up, it's not identical, but her searching his body and his available, the real estate of his face, the part of his skin that was showing, and she could see their life experience on him. And it was something she hadn't seen in 20 years. So it was just anything that was that connection with him and just noticing it. But Anne continues, when Jamie asks if he may kiss Claire, hearts break, tears fall. Aws all around. Then when he sees the pictures of Bree, after 20 years praying that she is safe, she and the child, to be able to actually see her grow up before his eyes with all the pictures, of course he falls apart. Then they begin to reconnect with common memories, food in the cabinet drawer. It is the shared day-to-day banalities that create a life and a marriage. This is where Outlander stops being the love story of Jamie and Claire and becomes a historical adventure drama. I'm not sure how I feel about that. Also, where did 4 hours go? When Jordy comes back, it is not yet noon, and then it's suddenly after four? I suppose she could have spent 4 hours just talking about Bree, but it seems like some other important personal information should have come up. Deborah C. writes, Claire is relieved that there is no sign of a woman in Jamie's room atop the print shop. When Jamie asks about their child, Claire shows him photos of Bree, and Jamie is so overwhelmed that, quote, he buried his face in Claire's shoulder and went very quietly and thoroughly to pieces, unquote. Martina P. writes, I am always happy to reread this wonderful chapter. The beautiful sequence of their reunion is literally breathtaking. My absolute favorite part of this chapter is when Jamie gets to see the photographs of Brianna and slowly goes to pieces. This is when I go right along with Jamie into pieces. Just heartbreakingly beautiful. Throughout it all, I had vivid images of Sam and Katrina. We all know very well how these two brilliant actors will kill the print shop scene. Good Lord, I can't wait. And I will never be able, even though we don't know him yet, I will never be able to forgive Mr. Willoughby for taking Jamie and Claire out of their most beautiful moment because he has to rescue the owner of the World's End from this drunkard. So that's the chapter.
Print shop.
That was actually pretty quick and dirty. In reading and taking notes, I got emotional. It was teary. It wasn't bawly, but it were single tears or wet eyes. But definitely when they meet, it has so much humor that it keeps it lighter, you know? Mm-hmm. When he falls to pieces, obviously that's sad. But to me, the most emotion of this is the anticipation. And then it's him looking at the photos. Because that's when he falls apart. And when he falls apart, that's when the pictures of Bree, I think that's going to be like probably the most heartbreaking thing, I think, of the season, if it's done right, you know?
I mean, everything has been leading to this moment.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, you tweeted earlier today about it was going to be a damp chapter.
Yeah.
And I was like,
your eyes, Summer. I don't know where.
I know. Well, I want you to know that it immediately made me think of the musical City of Angels.
Oh.
Where they have the line where they're talking about this very sexy woman, Allura's theme. And they say there won't be a dry seat in the house.
Oh, God.
That's nasty. You're like, damp chapter. And I was like, there won't be a dry seat in the house. That's where my brain goes.
Anyway, I'm broken.
You're broken?
I'm broken. That's how my brain goes.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.